There's a lot of fear in the world these days. From online extremism to rising sea levels to gun control, it can feel like the world is ending in slow motion. One new novel bundles all of these fears into one pre-apocalyptic package. It focuses on a family, two fathers, Andrew and Eric, and their adopted daughter, Wynn, and four intruders who approach their remote lake house and refuse to leave until they describe their apocalyptic visions and force the family to make a terrible choice. Stranded without access to the outside world, what ensues is a horrifying 24 hours where every rational argument has a cosmic explanation, and every decision may quite literally have an apocalyptic impact. Paul Tremblay's newest work is titled The Cabin at the End of the World, is published by William Morrow, and I am very pleased that he's able to join us here today. Welcome.
Thank you, DW. Man, you made that book sound awesome.
It is. It is terrifying in the best possible way.
Well, thank you.
Gripping. So the reader is made to question the veracity of the apocalyptic visions throughout the book. Talk about your decision to only slowly reveal these visions to readers.
One of my interests as an author, really my abiding interest, is in the idea of ambiguity. And I've really sort of become obsessed with how, on a personal level, with memory and identity, that's a lot more malleable than we like to think it is. And sort of the ambiguity of other people, how well do you really know somebody else? And then obviously on the universal level, what is this that we're living through? And I don't know. I mean, if you're going to write horror, to me, it just seems like an obvious thing to explore, the idea that, our reality and our very selves are a lot more malleable than we like to think it is. And particularly given now that we live in the misinformation age and what should have been the information age.
Right.
Yeah, why not?
What should have been the information age. I think we lose track of that pre-context. So is this a tale of sort of battle between rationality versus fatalism, or at least through one prism?
Yeah. Also, without getting too spoilery, hopefully it also becomes a story about, the choice that, the family is going to make, and whether or not they're going to choose, love over fear.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that, once I got deeper into the novel, it obviously plays with all our sort of current anxieties, but I really want to make sort of like this bigger picture story become more personal as it got deeper.
What's it like to write an almost second by second narration of events? This happens in real time.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the fun parts. I almost envisioned, not that I'm a playwright by any stretch, but I almost envisioned this as something that could be staged as a play, because it's, seven characters inside of a cabin. You see some things on a television, but really, I know that claustrophobia to me had a large appeal to it. And actually, I felt like it made it a little bit easier to write, just because even when I'm doing like the quieter character stuff, there is sort of these decisions and these horrible things that are going to happen weighing over everything. I feel like that just gave it this inherent feeling of dread.
So because of this close look at events in the sort of slower than real-time narration, the reader experiences the quick emotional turns that are being faced with an impossible decision, the possible decision that it can generate. Did you intend for your readers to feel a sort of confusion like the protagonists are feeling? You talked about ambiguity,
right,
but it's sort of a parallel experience between the protagonist and the reader?
No, absolutely. I really worked hard, and I've done this with the previous book as well, where I really try to, and not being spoilery, I really tried to build both sides of the arguments. I hope that readers, when they finish this book, there'll be some of them who can say, oh no, nothing supernatural is happening, and here's the case. But I also wanted to build the other side of it, where readers could go, oh no, something definitely supernatural is happening. I don't know, to me, I feel like that sort of mirrors what we're going through, just how it's so difficult to know what it is that's what we're actually living through right now.
Throughout the book, you articulate both the plausibility and the insanity of the visions being thrust upon the family. There's a moment about halfway through the book when one of the captors says, and I quote, "Only crazy people keep having tidal wave nightmares with people getting swallowed up at the Goonies Rock," right? She laughs again, demonstrating what her going crazy would sound like. Did you end up having apocalyptic dreams while working on this book? Or did you have a sense of what you were writing about there?
No, I didn't. But as someone who grew up in the Cold War 80s, I was a child during the Reagan, Russia spy, Star Wars year. So no, at a certain point in my life, I've always sort of had the fear of nuclear war. And, I wish that sort of retro fear wasn't brought back for us, in 2018. But no, I mean, that's always been a fear of mine. I'm afraid of everything, but certainly end of the world fears is part of It's a part of
what Nuclear Holocaust what has to be right up there, top of the list, I would think. I'm D.W. Gibson, and I'm speaking with Paul Tremblay about his new book, The Cabin at the End of the World. It's published by William Morrow. Each section of the book is written from the perspective of a different character or a pair of characters. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to break up the narrative structure this way?
Well, one reason, there was a few scenes I wanted to have different people viewing the same scenes, to sort of help build the doubt within the minds of the reader. One of the characters ends up getting a concussion, so you really can't trust maybe the vision, what he sees.
Right.
So it was all just to help build a little bit of doubt. And also, a way to build the family characters as well.
Most of the chapters are narrated from the perspective of someone in the family, but about two-thirds of the way through, you shift to narrating some chapters from the perspective of the home invaders.
Right.
Talk about that sort of challenge and writing from their perspective and why you went there.
Sure. So I would say three of the four invaders I wanted to treat from a base of empathy, because I thought their experience is a horror as well. Not sympathy. I certainly don't want anyone sympathizing with the invaders, but the idea that, some of these people are there because they truly believe they had no choice. To me, that's a horror. I mean, it's also one that is a little bit enticing, because the idea of being able to just give yourself over and abdicate all personal responsibility.
And be given a task.
Yeah, and I think people would like that. But that's the break of the social compact once you say you have no responsibility. It's not your fault. So I thought that the intruders' experience, or some of them anyway, a couple of them in particular, that their experience was a horror worth exploring as well.
Time and time again, the book returns to the question of what religion the characters were or weren't raised with, especially when it's made clear that she was raised without religion. Do you think being raised with a semblance of an understanding of cosmic proportions via religion would be helpful when dealing with what might be the end of the world?
Oh, boy. That's a hard question.
It sort of goes into this sort of space you're talking about, and where people sort of feel more comfortable, right? Or have some sense of order or some sense of surrender.
Right. No, I think that goes back to the idea of how much of your own personal belief are you willing to give over to something else? In Wen's case, honestly, that reflects my children's case, because, my wife and I have brought up our children with essentially, zero religion. And it's something, I grew up Catholic for about 7 or 8 years. Before my family sort of stopped. But, so I've had that base, so it's, I think about my children's point of view sometimes, what do they think about this? But I came to the realization fairly recently, wow, America is really a religious country, one of the most religious countries, certainly in the Western world, especially after spending a week in England, where it is, I don't know, I think it's 50% agnostic atheist. And I don't know, it's almost inescapable, even for someone who considers himself an agnostic. Particularly growing up in New England, where there's, still the Gothic Puritan is a big part of where I grew up and still live. Yeah, so I mean, all of that I wanted to sort of throw in the stew of the book.
You slowly reveal that the antagonists actually met on an online message board. One of the fathers, Andrew, wonders if these people think of themselves as TIs or targeted individuals. Mm-hmm. What are TIs, and are they a real digital phenomenon?
They are. Actually, there was a huge expose in the New York Times, I believe, within the last couple of years about TIs. So this is a group of people who are really suffering from classic schizophrenic, almost psychotic break symptoms, where they believe that people are watching them, they're sending them terrible messages, trying to get them to do bad things. And mostly it's about they think the government or other people are following them or watching them. So instead of seeking out treatment, because when they seek out treatment, their beliefs get rebuked and told that this is an illness, they seek comfort out online and they find others like them. And there's all these gatherings of TIs who just reinforce what they're believing. And in fact, there was a shooter in an army base. There's so many shootings. I can't remember exactly when it was. I don't mean to laugh. It's sort of like a sad laugh.
Yeah.
I can't remember the gentleman's name. That's probably fine. But he shot 3 people on an army base, and he was someone who was a part of a TI sort of group.
It just points to the fact that the internet is a place where one can receive whatever information one wants to receive.
Absolutely.
Right? One review compared your book with other online-generated conspiracy theories like Pizzagate. Is this an intentional parallel?
So I started writing the book in the summer of 2016 during the primary season. And I usually don't start a book with a subtext, but I definitely started it with the hope that, without being too didactic, the novel would work as an allegory for our current socio-political predicament, shall we say. And so much so, even though I was only like 50 pages in a summary in about the time when President Trump was elected, after his election, the novel, the ending to the book in my mind changed. I won't say one way or the other without spoiling the ending, but
right,
yeah.
But certainly that was sort of part of the impetus for this book, the sort of the political environment, the cultural environment that we sort of entered into with the idea of fake news and the repetition of that phrase and how we might all construe that phrase, right?
No, absolutely. And even some of the intruders I was trying to criticize, sort of my people on the left. I mean, the idea that you have, you know, these liberals will say the right thing, but when push comes to shove, you know, they're not actually going to do the right thing to help, you know, people different than them necessarily.
I don't think it's giving too much away to say that the fathers end up being of two minds about the visions.
Right.
Did you see this struggle as a symptom of Stockholm syndrome?
No, I really wanted to make it sort of a part of their personalities. And given that, you know, one of the dads, Eric, did grow up in a very Catholic family. And obviously his parents had a hard time with him and for, you know, for being a gay man for a while when he first told them. You know, and Andrew is very much, you know, lifelong sort of agnostic atheist. So I did want to have, you know, as close as they are, you know, that's where I wanted to have the struggle. Because to me, the story becomes about Andrew and Eric. You know, what is the ultimate choice that they're going to make?
Right. Well, is there a theme in the book about keeping and breaking promises? That seems to be playing a part as well.
Well, sure. I mean, I think that's part of sort of any familial relationship, right? I mean, the idea of, you know, how much, you know, how I talked about the social compact. What's the family compact? Are you going to be able to be there for the other person in the darkest hour kind of thing?
It seems to play out sort of on that intimate level and societal level. It really stood out to me in that way. The book almost reads like a story of star-crossed lovers, too, in this way. Can an apocalyptic horror story also be a love story?
I love it when people describe it as a love story.
Yeah.
You know, I do... It's funny, when you describe the book, I mean, it sounds like, geez, why would I want to read this? Since we're living through it, but... I don't know. I kind of approach this book with what I like to call the hope of horror, which sounds like a, you know, oxymoron to say the hope of horror. Well, to me, the hope of horror is, you know, yes, the characters may or may not survive. They may not be able to fix the problem that's revealed. And to me, in a horror story, if we're going to boil it down, there's this reveal of some terrible truth. It could be a social truth, a societal truth, a personal truth. And then what happens after the reveal, to me, is what makes a horror story. So to me, the horror of hope is, yeah, we may not survive, but there's that shared recognition that this is wrong. So to me, there's like a defiance, I don't know, almost like a punk rock, like fist raise. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think there's a hopeful recognition value in that.
Do you feel like, obviously, if you're going out and meeting readers, there are people who might already be fond of your work, but do you feel like you're able to sort of, I guess, help along conversations about misinformation in the world we're living in and have people be receptive to that? Has it been inclusive conversations that you've had with readers?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I have no idea how much the effect. I mean, I think it's more just a reflection of what we already know is happening. My first horror novel called A Head Full of Ghosts, sort of plays with the same idea. And there's a reality TV show that sort of gets in the way of the goings on of a family that's disintegrating because of maybe possession. But it has been, you know, made for wonderful conversations about how much the internet is a part of our lives and how much it separates us and, you know, how much it skews our viewpoints.
And, you know, towards the end of the book, you reference sci-fi book by William Gibson when you describe ominous clouds as being a neuromancer sky. Is that book an inspiration at all?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, as a writer, I feel like I'm a magpie and I love to take little bits and pieces, you know, and put them together in sort of my own way. You know, I would even say, I've been saying this out on tour, that one of the books that I reread to just get me in the mental space of this book. I mean, it's not similar in terms of story, but in feel. I reread Lord of the Flies. And the first paragraph of Cabin is sort of like a riff on the opening lines of the Lord of the Flies as well. Again, you know, just sort of the fun stuff writers play to keep us entertained while we're writing.
Sure. No, that makes sense now that you've mentioned that. Yeah. Well, it is a terrifying book, and I say that in the best possible way. It keeps one turning the pages for sure, and I'm grateful that you've been here today to discuss it with me.
Well, thank you, D.W. I really appreciate it.
I'm D.W. Gibson, and I've been speaking with Paul Tremblay about his new novel, The Cabin at the End of the World, published by William Morrow.